Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. We trust you had a wonderful Labor Day weekend, and pretty much everybody's kids are in school now. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual, Jim. And I guess it's not a snow day in Fairfax County, so I assume your kids started today.
Not yet. That doesn't start till next week.
On to the good martini now, and admittedly, it was a little bit of a search for the good martini today, but Jim, just last week, the president was up in Alaska taking selfies with glaciers that were melting in August and early September. Shocking that that was happening in Alaska, and he was using that to advance his climate change agenda, or at least trying to, but the facts just simply aren't cooperating. This is according to NBC, actually. A new but controversial study asks if an end is coming to the busy Atlantic hurricane seasons of recent decades. The Atlantic looks like it is entering a new, quieter cycle of storm activity like the 70s and 80s, two prominent hurricane researchers wrote Monday in the journal Nature Geoscience. Scientists at Colorado State, including the professor who pioneered hurricane seasonal prognostication, say they are seeing a localized cooling and salinity level drop in the North Atlantic near Greenland. Those conditions, they theorize, change local weather and ocean patterns and form an on-again, off-again cycle in hurricane activity that they trace back to the late 1800s. So, Jim, it almost appears that the climate naturally goes through cycles, and right now it appears to be cooling in certain parts that mean quieter hurricane seasons. We're also hearing folks talk about less solar activity, which means we're in a bit of a cooling period for the past several years. So, amazing how that works.
This is a twofold good martini. The first being that if these scientists at Colorado State University are accurate, then yes, we're in for a period that could last up to 25 years of milder storm seasons. Now, this doesn't mean that there's not going to be hurricanes or that there's no chance of having a really bad hurricane in the Atlantic. It just means that as far as cycles go, water temperature, air temperature, all that kind of stuff, he thinks he's determined that there's a pattern, and the last one probably started around 95, ended in 2012. We'll remember Hurricane Katrina probably being the peak of that. If that's the case, this is terrific. Even if it isn't, 100% accurate and it doesn't last 25 years and all of this, it's just really refreshing to see scientists saying that, one, not everything we know about climate relates to this doomsday scenario, and that, two, look, there's things about climate we don't completely understand. These are extraordinarily complicated ecosystems with all kinds of variables interacting with each other. The idea that, if we don't give money to Al Gore, the world's going to blow up is always been this way too simplistic narrative here. And so if it is great, it'd probably be irritating to the Greens that they always seem to, cherish and enjoy the terrible hurricanes as a sign of we have irked Gaia. We need to sacrifice to Mother Earth, and we'd burn our SUVs, except the carbon emissions from that are pretty bad too. But again, if we end up with a decade or two decades of mild hurricane seasons, that'll be pretty good to see. And, obviously it doesn't mean no one should ignore hurricane warnings and things like that, but good to see some of the hype of this era of superstorms. They turn out to be a bunch of stuff and nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. Hot air, you might say.
There you go. Very good. Thank you. That was the pun I was looking for.
Not only does it mean, obviously, most likely, less destructive storms, which is great for folks in those areas, but helps in the larger debate as well. Speaking of larger debates, we had some developments in the Iran nuclear deal debate over the weekend. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell gave us another reason to smack ourselves in the forehead for his ongoing allegiance to Barack Obama. This one, his endorsement of the Iran deal. Here's a couple of clips on that from his Sunday appearance on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd.
Let's start right with Iran. Is this a good deal?
I think it is a good deal. I've studied very carefully the outline of the deal and what's in that deal. And I've also carefully looked at the opposition to the deal. And my judgment after balancing those two sets of information is that it's a pretty good deal.
So that's bad martini number one, the former Secretary of State who led the case against Iraq at the United Nations back in 2003. Totally on board, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't understand, unfortunately, how this deal's actually structured, Jim.
Now, will they comply with it? Will they actually do all of this? Well, they get nothing until they show compliance, and that's the important part of the arrangement.
Well, that's certainly not Iran's understanding of the arrangement, but that's only bad part of the martini number one. Number two, And you would think initially this is good news, but West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin announcing today that he will vote against the nuclear deal, saying that for me, this deal had to address Iran's terrorist actions. Without doing so, would reward Iran's 36 years of deplorable behavior and do nothing to prevent its destructive activities. That's great. It just stinks, Jim, that he waited until after the president had the votes and couldn't help build a little momentum opposing this thing, since the president flat out admitted several times that this doesn't address Iran's terrorist activities whatsoever.
Welcome to the party, pal. great. Thanks. You know, in fact, Manchin was one of those guys who people kind of figured to be opposing this thing from the beginning. You figured this was not the sort of thing that would poll particularly well in West Virginia. Unsurprisingly, now that they know they've got the votes, now it's safe for him to come out. Because if he'd done it beforehand, maybe he'd have momentum. Even there'd be a bad narrative, even be trouble for the administration. Real profile and courage, that one. On Colin Powell, it's just really frustrating. I have a very cynical view of Colin Powell ever since his endorsement of Obama and then his subsequent endorsement of Obama for re-election. A cynical mind might think he's doing everything he possibly can to distance himself from the Iraq war and his role in the case for that in 2003. I suppose people would say we should take Colin Powell at his word and say this is not some sort of PR effort, that he genuinely believes what he's saying. But I think, as you pointed out, I think his interpretation of the deal is just totally wrong. And it just assumes that the Iranians will do things and that the sequence, the order of how this deal works, it's really disappointing to see who he was in 1996 and how the country saw him, to see him suddenly reduced to the level of Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
That's an interesting comparison that I don't think a lot of people had made. I guess if there's any silver lining from Joe Manchin doing so after the president's got the votes to save it, is that now I think we're only two votes away from actually getting past the filibuster, making the president veto it. He's still most likely going to win, but at least we are going to get to that point of the process, which in the long term, I'm not sure how much that's worth, but at least it's slightly less embarrassing for those of us trying to stop it. Also interesting, normally Chuck Schumer, people like him, Bob Menendez, pretty hard to separate them in a TV camera. Haven't seen him once out there trying to convince anyone else to vote against this thing, which is very, very odd.
You know, that's a fascinating observation. Man, I wonder, if he's locked away somewhere.
All right. We haven't talked about Trump yet. Let's get to the crazy martini. This is courtesy of Jim's reporting in the Morning Jolt today. Although this actually comes from the New York Times, this initial story, Donald Trump, who received draft deferments through much of the Vietnam War, told the author of a forthcoming biography that he nevertheless always felt that I was in the military because of his education at a military-themed boarding school. Mr. Trump said that his experience at the New York Military Academy, an expensive prep school where his parents had sent him to correct poor behavior, gave him, quote, more training militarily than a lot of guys that go into the military, unquote. According to the book, Trump attended the school after years of rowdy and rebellious behavior at a more traditional prep school in Queens. He arrived at the military academy for eighth grade, stayed there through high school. Jim, I think there's a lot of people who have served, whether they were in combat or not, who might question whether a kid who went to a military-style approach in high school really has more military training than they do.
I put this out today. There are times where things have gotten quite combative with the Trump supporters. And sometimes I think, okay, I should try to see things from their point of view. I should try to see what's really going on. I should try to see if there's some angle I've missed. And then I see something like this, like, no, my assessment of Donald Trump has been pretty right from the beginning. That this is a guy who, says, I always felt that I was in the military. The quote that really gets me was, he believed that because he went to this prep school, the New York Military Academy, he gave him, quote, more training militarily than a lot of the guys who go into the military. I think that's crazy. I think that's a crazy thing for a presidential candidate to say. I think it's a crazy thing for an aspiring commander in chief to say. I look at that and I think this guy is not in touch with reality. And the fascinating thing is, like, I put this out there and the Trump fans are, no, you're crazy, Garrity. You're the one, go serve your rhino puppet, Matt, yada, yada, yada. And I don't really want a commander in chief who thinks that because he went to a military academy, he's more training militarily than the guys who are actually in the military. Throw this in with the McCain comment or something like that. It's not, I don't think it's particularly like disrespect for veterans or people who served in the military, Greg, because I don't think Trump singles them out for disrespect. I think he simply isn't respectful of people who aren't him. And for this, I'll just point to the quote. At one point, in another quote for this forthcoming book, he says, "For the most part, you can't respect people because most people aren't worthy of respect." Greg, how does that kind of philosophy in a president grab you?
It's going to be hard for him to go to the diners and coffee shops in Iowa and New Hampshire with that message.
Oh, you could buy the diner. No, like, I mean, here's a guy who, like, if you seem like he acts like he has contempt and disrespect and this kind of arrogant attitude and all that to everybody else, okay, fine. I think it kind of verifies that. But he openly says that he doesn't respect people. That's part of his philosophy. He thinks that most people aren't worthy of respect. Now, part of our whole, we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal, endowed by their creator. You know, like the whole idea, one of the ideas of it is everybody has a value, right? We don't have a king. We don't have aristocracy. We're all equal in the eyes of the law, and everybody's supposed to be treated the same. And the idea, this president just openly believes that I don't believe most people are worthy of respect. Like, this is a really dangerous attitude to have in government. And how this is the antidote or to the arrogance and contempt we've seen in the Obama administration, I'm just baffled by this. And I guess some people think, well, he's going to be arrogant and contemptuous on our side. I can't jump over that. I can't bridge that gap. So that's how I see things. And I'm sure I'll get plenty of angry emails and missives and Twitter messages and all that stuff from the Trump fans. Because, you know, most people aren't worthy of respect might as well be the Trump slogan. And, most of his fans seem to embrace that philosophy as well.
On that note, Jim, not much more to say. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.